This is CliffCentral.com.
Yes, that's what Bahati said when they met. Well, she made it sound as high pitch as that, but she definitely said, take me all the way. Right, so it is the July month, and it's the 3rd of July, which means tomorrow is the 4th of July, which means that Adam Levine and Bahati and all other Americans are going to be all over our Instagrams, our Twitter, our everything. All
right.
Celebrating Independence Day. And then the rest of the world somehow takes on these American holidays as their own. Any excuse to go get hammered or show off your beach body.
I'm sorry. Did you just check what underwear you're wearing?
Yeah.
Why?
I have these American flag underwear. Okay. And I realize I'm actually wearing it this morning.
All right.
Wow, okay. See, you are such a story.
To prove your point, Ben. Yes, exactly.
There we go. See, people then take it on by themselves.
Yeah. So that's exactly what tipped me off. Hey, we celebrate in different ways.
Yeah. Well, look, it's cool for them, of course, because it's the middle of their summer, right? So 4th of July is like a really great day. It's the whole independence thing, of course, so it's like you'd be nice and patriotic and it's American flags all over the place. But as Southern Hemisphere people, well, we are still shivering our
behinds off,
various genitalias off, and it's not a big day for us at all. But hey, tomorrow maybe we can chat to some of our American listeners if you are keen to share what Independence Day means to you living in the land of Donald Trump. Then, you can always chat to us.
I think tomorrow morning we'd still be speaking to them on the 3rd.
Also true.
Yeah.
Smart.
So if we wanted to speak to them about the 4th of July.
It'll be on the 5th.
Our 5th, their 4th. Wow, that is a bit of a mind fuck.
There we go.
That was a lot.
And there it is. Teamwork. Teamwork of the highest order. Right, so we've got Aubrey coming through. And man, looking through this guy's bio, the things that he's done, and again, it's like I was saying earlier, the vision to translate stories and things that have been kind of traumatic or kind of been very problematic or iconic in South Africa's history, and to bring it through to place where people can enjoy it or appreciate it more. It takes a special kind of person, but before he gets in here, we still got some time for some more news stories, and hopefully Gareth will be back tomorrow after his fever. So if you were wondering where he is, he's a little bit ill today. Mubs, anything else of interest this Monday?
Well, an interesting hearing is about to take place thanks to the National Consumer Commission. They are going to begin public hearings on the vacation ownership timeshare industry. I had no idea that there's a bit of scandal happening in that
this
part
industry.
Of the world.
This industry, I tell you what, it is a scam of note.
The inquiry is tasked with getting to the bottom of how consumers are apparently being forced into contracts without the option of ever cancelling. The commission has accused the industry's regulatory body of doing nothing about it. Paying upfront to use a holiday home of your dreams seems like a good deal for as many as about 700,000 South Africans who are timeshare owners. But this 2 billion rand industry has come under the spotlight recently for all the wrong reasons. The National Consumer Commission National Consumer Commission Commissioner Ibrahim Mohammed has said that consumers allege that, among other things, that they have been misled into signing up for a lifetime contract that can never be cancelled. They further allege that companies overbook and oversell accommodation. Is anybody here involved in timeshare?
My parents have some timeshare, and there's certain places that they strangely can never go to every year.
Well, that's
oversubscribed and
yeah, that's probably because of the overbooking and the overselling of accommodation.
I mean, these guys are worse than the airlines. They really are.
Yeah. So the National Consumer Commission has always held the view that complaints from timeshare consumers are valid and warranted. And now finally they have decided that they are going to have some other sort of inquiry, which is why these public hearings are going to take place. Apparently such grievances that were listed date back 2 decades. According to one attorney, Anton Alberts, he says that he is dealing with at least 5,000 complaints from consumers who have suffered at the hands of holiday clubs. I mean, it sounds to me like it's a kind of syndicate, if you will. Like you trap people into lifetime contracts that they are unable to get out of. That's very dubious.
And how do these people think they can go about justifying what they do?
Well, I suppose.
And how do they think they won't even get caught out?
Well, I suppose this is why these public hearings are now going to take place, where people who are essentially involved in timeshare are being encouraged to come forward with their stories to build some other kind of case against the industry.
Yeah.
2 billion rands worth.
Look, I think what's also quite sad is that people are being taken advantage of a more mature age as well. So they see that. I mean, look, the whole timeshare thing is a great, it's a great idea. It really is. But people are being taken advantage of all the time for all these like fancy pamphlets. And in theory, it all works. But then it's like, well, we can't help you this time around. You're like, oh, okay, all right, we'll try somewhere else.
Yeah, according to this Anton Alberts, he says that there's a very aggressive marketing scheme that is being used. And people feel that they are being bullied into these contracts, which is where I suppose, you know, the mature age group probably are easier to bully than somebody who's maybe younger.
I told you, like, we went on the timeshare thing last year, Daniel and I.
No, you didn't.
So there was this like amazingly good deal to go to a certain part of Thailand, right? So what you do is you pay like next to nothing. Just get there. And then you pay like a nominal service fee. And then you get a bit of a timeshare speech. Eh, how hard can it be? So yeah, you get to this place and true to their word, they lay everything on. And it was really good. And then you get the timeshare talk. And look, they ask for a fair amount of money up front. And then they offer you places around the world. And then they offer you some other little kicker deals, which, look, it all sounded fantastic, right? I looked around, and it's all the same people. They're, like, sort of late 40s, early 50s, that kind of era. And they're all being dazzled by these young salespeople.
Yeah.
All on these dreams, you know, because a lot of people who have timeshare or go into timeshare, they never traveled when they were younger, right? So they all have this mindset, like, we have to travel more. We have to go to these places. So they arrive there knowing that they almost have to buy, and now they're being sold into these other deals. I mean, like, we're different, so we'll travel in our own accord and that kind of stuff because that's just how our lives have been structured. But you see these people, and then the wife basically, and you see how these things work. They play on the heartstrings of the wife, who then pressures the husband, and the husband's like, well,
fine, I give in.
Basically, if I do this, I don't have to plan any holidays for the rest of my life. These guys will take care of it for me. She'll be happy. She's not going to moan. Let's make this happen.
Well, the vacation ownership industry answers to a self-regulated member-based trade association.
Oh, that sounds like the ANC. That's just dodgy. Yeah, you can't self-regulate.
You can't self-regulate because, I mean, it's... I mean, the irony of self-regulating your... Please.
Yeah.
So this association is called the Vacation Ownership of Southern Africa, but the organization has denied that it's turning a blind eye to these problems. Essentially saying, no, 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 everything is fine here. Everything is fine. I mean, it reminds me of that FIFA. What's that one branch of FIFA? The FIFA
Ethics Committee.
Ethics Committee. Yeah. Now, please give me a break.
Yeah.
So, yeah. As I said, these public hearings will start today. And over the next 2 days, the commission will hear submissions from Gauteng-based consumers. The NCC is encouraging whistleblowers, as well as members of the public and regulatory bodies, to participate.
Go on, whistleblowers.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is this? I bet you wouldn't guess this.
Wait, what is this?
Someone's doing a magic trick. And... That noise in the background is a woman laughing at an orangutan. Okay, that didn't go as planned.
Wait, what?
What was the plan, Ben?
Please bring us into your world.
My plan was to play the audio of a laughing orangutan.
Oh, so you were hoping that...
And now I'm just... Yeah, it's gone badly, Mubs. There we go. Okay, I've failed. Right. I failed miserably in creating a funny segue.
Ben, as the successful people in the world say, failure is part of the journey, so don't be too hard on yourself.
I might as well be a snorer. I failed so badly. But anyway, interesting clip. I will be sure to add it to... So I told you last week that if we do interesting things in the show... which we kind of do because we're not so bad at this, then we'll share it on the Cliff Central actual website. So if you go to cliffcentral.com, on the pages where you find our podcast, where you can catch up on stuff, there will be various clips and various things that we've done. So a laughing orangutan will be your treat today when you go onto the website and catch these podcasts.
The one-stop shop. There you go.
A laughing orangutan that doesn't actually laugh.
Well, you see it laugh. You can hear it laugh because... humans being humans, is behind a big glass wall. Anyway, decent save.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, as we know, you know, the weed conversation is one that we're all interested in to see how far we go and how far people can push the boundaries.
Yeah, because it's a bit of a gray area, see, because it's legal, then it's not legal, and
that's
then
it.
Yeah. I don't know where I stand with this.
So the true trailblazers in all of this are America. So as much as they are gearing up to, you know, celebrate their independence tomorrow, this weekend rather, Las Vegas was the only, well, Las Vegas, which is in Nevada, is the only state where both gambling and prostitution are legal, as we know, and is now going to add recreational marijuana to its list.
Do wonders for tourism, that will.
That is all I'm thinking. That's the entire reason I'm bringing this up.
Nevada is the only state where prostitution is legal in that big country?
And gambling.
That surprises me.
And gambling.
Gambling, I understand.
But there are casinos everywhere else, which I don't understand. But or maybe it's just a combo of both prostitution and gambling. Maybe other states just purely have gambling. You know, there's Atlantis Atlantis City, I think.
That's where all New Yorkers gamble.
There we go. Yes. So now, like, imagine the stories that will come out of...
No stories here, because what happens in Vegas stays there.
Listen, girl,
except the herb.
Except the herb.
But there are a number of states where marijuana use is legal now. So Nevada are joining on kind of late to the party.
But this is for recreational purposes. You know, everyone else, there's still the medicinal marijuana card or this in small dosages. But as of Saturday, Nevada was now legally able to add recreational marijuana to its list of indulgences for adults. And sales kicked off on Saturday with dozens of shops, like having different marijuana products, this, that, and the other. So when you gamble, you can now get a little lady or man of the night, and you have a little bird, and you have a good time. But my goodness, will Las Vegas get even wilder?
I don't know if this makes Nevada just very forward-thinking, or if it makes them like the black sheep of the family.
Well, I'm guessing it's in a desert, so you got to attract people somehow.
Yeah.
So it's kind of smart. But you showed great surprise on Buddy Malloy to the fact that there's the only state where these things are legal.
Yeah.
But did you know there's 27 states in America where you can marry a minor? As in not someone who gets natural resources from the ground, but a woman of less than 18 years old.
Oh, wow. People's
27 states.
Yes. People's priorities are all over the place.
If you want to raise an eyebrow at Nevada, well, 27 states mean that you can marry a 12-year-old.
You see, I would assume that such a law was created back in the day, hopefully with good intentions.
No, what good intentions?
I mean,
good intentions for
what? Good intentions for who?
Young children.
You are marrying off a child to some gross man.
No,
Wait.
Let me explain myself. I mean, like, I know of someone, well, a couple who literally waited up until they were 18 before they legally got married. And they were both the same age. Mm. I don't mean of like these beastie, greedy old men who are like 70 and they're getting married to these 12-year-olds. I get it. We can shun upon that. But I mean, in like the Amish community, when you're like a teenager, you are definitely like instantly regarded as an adult.
So
for them, you can now, and having a child when you're together with someone at 15 isn't shunned upon. So that's what I mean with good intentions. But I know, in this society, they're like, no,
so
sickos.
Essentially, those states that you're talking about, Ben, there is no such thing as statutory rape then in those states.
Well, exactly.
Benjamin, what is that? Is that what old people who get married to young kids sound like?
No, see, it's an orangutan. It's your mind and times. I thought, you know, I cheated you out of an orangutan experience. There you go, that's an orangutan.
I'm trying to work with your segues. 27 states, that's more than half, which is, yeah, sad. Disgusting, actually.
But I guess.
But these are probably also the same states where you're allowed to fornicate with a pig or...
Well, look, okay. I mean, there's a big difference between fornicating with a pig.
There are parts of America where it is completely legal for you to have... For bestiality, essentially. It's allowed.
Well, hey, on the marijuana deal, so having some sort of legality in this as well, you authorized marijuana shops in Las Vegas or the state of Nevada will only be able to sell up to 1 ounce, which is 28 grams, for recreational use by customers who are 21 years or older. And, hey, good time. Make that happen then, I guess.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, this whole thing, we've spoken about it at length, this whole marijuana subject.
Mm.
Let's just try to stick to that, even though Mabali wants us to go into bestiality. Is that we've got to be grown-ups around this. We've really got to just become more mature.
We aren't going to, though.
But it has to happen this year, in our lifetimes, and pretty soon. And again, I go back to South Africa's problems, right, and how mm-hmm. we can solve them by just not being stupid, not being so counterproductive. Is that Eastern Cape tourism? Mm-hmm. Let's make it the best weed province in all of the world.
Why? Just justify this again. Let me understand.
There's land that can make this happen. The climate's mm-hmm. good. Let's just have the biggest weed plantations going. We can have so much good things. So many different people. That's how you get empowerment. The whole thing about, you know, farming. Nobody wants to farm potatoes and stuff like that. They want to farm weed. And if we do that, then we can have like amazing establishments.
I'm just trying to
weed travel.
I'm really trying to picture this happening as a discussion in Parliament. You know, the Minister of Travel and Tourism standing up
next to Minister of Agriculture.
There we go. You know, banding up together, explaining this. The hills are alive with the sound of marijuana.
Look, at the end of it, it's just economics, right? You're getting more people coming into your country, spending foreign money in your country. You're creating employment, which means more people are, or less people are, unemployed. Mm. And it's as simple as that, really. So it's not even me wanting weed.
It's once the stigma is totally, you know, gone, then we can have adult conversations around this. But right now, people are still imposed. You mean, like, right now in America as well, the U.S. Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, had long opposed...
Who?
Yeah, I know. His surname is Sessions. Let's move past that. Had long opposed...
Sessions with Jeff.
Can't we be serious? This is why we can't have serious conversations. He, you know, described marijuana as something that is only slightly less awful than heroin and said that the United States needed to discourage drug use.
Ah, screw you, Jeff.
People are still bringing their own, you know.
All right, our guest of the morning, Aubrey, is here, so we can take a little break and welcome him into the studio, and then we can hear about his life, his productions, his visions, all these different kind of things. So not his visions, I make him sound like he's a psychic or something. His vision
fortune
towards
teller.
His productions,
there
that
we
kind
go.
Of stuff, yeah. So Gareth was speaking about Macassar last week, so we're going to play a bit of that and then welcome in Aubrey into it. Your body. Or is it Mabali?
Mabali. Mabali.
Right. See, I was saying these guys don't really get old. Right? You know, I guess it's like one of the greatest compliments for music is that it's kind of timeless.
Mm. Yeah. It doesn't matter if you're listening to it now or if you'll be listening to it 10 years from now, it will still go in.
All right, our guest is here, Aubrey Sechabi. Is that correct? Did I pronounce that right? Okay, cool. I should turn your mic on top of that. That's going to be the real kicker for this interview. So, Aubrey, we've been talking about you throughout the show so far. Morning, welcome to it.
Good morning, thank you.
Thanks for coming through. Now, Aubrey, your CV, your bio is quite something. A multi-awarded, decorated playwright, director. I mean, this has been something your entire life being. Over 60 nominations for your work, and obviously numerous awards along the way. Are you a born and bred Gauteng person?
Yes, I'm born and bred in Gauteng, Pretoria, specifically.
Okay. Now, yeah. Let me get this right. At the age of 15, you wrote your first play.
Yes, Save the People.
So while other kids...
What was I doing at 15?
So while other kids were, I don't know, playing football, trying to hook up with girls, I don't know, steal sweets from their friends, an entire playwright. So obviously something right from day one, this has been a massive passion of yours.
Yeah, I think that's what I've always done. Even when I was like about 9, I represented my school in a poetry session, and I think I won
right.
in 1978. So... That's all I've done, and I started acting actually when I was like 13, and the guy who used to write for us, J.K. Mabusebo, I think he got a job at Telkom at the time, and he left, and so there we were, like with no play. And then there was this young guy who used to be an athlete, a sprinter actually. His name is Ben, I forgot his surname. And he got shot by a cop that we used to call Rambo, and his leg was amputated. And then I wrote that play, Save the People, because it was just, I don't know, it just affected me because I'd been in primary with him and we were in high school, and there he could no longer run, so it was really painful for me. And then I wrote Save the People based on that.
And then within that, obviously, you discovered this is a bit of a talent that you have.
I thought, yeah, this is what I want to do, because I was an actor. I was an actor until I decided to stop, to say I just want to focus on writing and directing. After I graduated from Vets, I thought, you know what? I've gone to a couple of auditions, and I thought, I remember I was in a taxi driving back home, and I thought, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm just going to write and direct and create work for myself.
It must have been also a bit of a therapeutic process, given, you know, those times, those days, the kinds of events that were happening around you, for you to then write about it and then use that as a way to, you know, to tell your stories. That must have been a therapeutic process as well.
Well, it felt good because I knew the guy and we'd gone to school with him. And at the time, you know, we'd just been exposed to protest theater. We've just been exposed to like productions like Woza Albert, because when you're from the township, what could have been exposed to in terms of theater would have been Gibson Kent's work. And I just seen Give a Child, I think, and Things Are Bad. And you always went out, you know, and the people that taught you acting, like JK, they were inspired by Gibson Kente, you know. So when after I'd seen Woza Albert and all that, we knew that we needed to do stories. And Woza Albert was just so close to the bone. When you saw Woza Albert, you could relate with the characters. And that's what I thought, you know what, this story that's happening, this tragedy, is actually something that one could write about. And really, I think after that performance, one started accepting things, but knowing that you have to use theater to fight things and to tell and reflect the rhythm and the mood of the time.
It's so true, though, because a lot of stories, I mean, if you look back in South Africa's history, it's because of the story that people are able to deal with certain things. Now, so from, obviously, starting early with this, you then went on to Wits, where you got an honors degree in dramatic arts. So that was back in 1991. These were, well, turbulent times, I guess you can say, in this country's history. As a young playwright coming through, I mean, there weren't a lot of great stories that kind of got into it. You just say that obviously this shaped how you then envisioned a story. It was a story of bringing out a lot of hurts and bringing out for the good of getting the word across.
I'd say that, you know, I think when we were at Vets, at the time, I think there was about 9 black students in the whole drama department. You know, we were 6 first years and I think 2 second years. It was 10 and 3 third years and 1 fourth year. The only lady actually at the time, Lindin Develekok, she's working for Department of Arts and Culture now. And when we went to Vets, I think a lot of us, because you've done grassroots theatre, you've done community theatre, so you had an idea. I had already written 3 plays, I think, by then, and which had performed in the university, said Medusa, but all those productions were like, about, it was protest. But when we were at Vets, we also felt that, or I felt that we were not even doing the sort of work that we wanted to do. You know, you go there, you're doing Shakespeare, you're doing a Chekhov, you know, you're doing all these things. So good, you know, some of them are amazing and great playwrights.
Yeah, you're learning things.
Yeah. Yes, but we kind of felt like we're not doing our stuff, you know, and we formed a company then. It was in our first year. I was a bit of a rebel. So we formed a company, VEM Productions, V4, Victor Aubrey and Mishak Productions. Mishak is now the acting CEO of Parkoffs. And we did a play called My Home, My Prison. But also when we did My Home, My Prison, we were trying to workshop it. And we went to fetch Mishak in the Northwest on the 12th of January. And then we got arrested. There was a roadblock in Lichtenberg. They arrested us. Victor, it was Victor's birthday on the 13th. So we were in the church office and they were harassing us. Plus in our school book bags, we had like pamphlets of BSS, Black Student Movement. So they were taking all that and reading all that and finding scripts for film that we're doing that were political, and they harassed us and they made me sing Michael Jackson's Bad. Actually, I had to sing Bad.
They made you sing a Michael Jackson
yes,
song.
Yes, because they asked me who was my favorite musician, and I said Michael Jackson, and they said, can you sing to us? Yeah, I don't know. And I said, go for it. And there I was on top of the table, they were singing. And they let us go at like 5 o'clock in the morning, and they just said, oppat, oppat, oppat. And My Home, My Prison just grew from there. It became just about our experiences with the cops, because we had a lot of those experiences. We had a Mazda 323 that we used to tour with. And we were just constantly stopped, constantly harassed, and that made My Home, My Prison. So at that stage, it was just reflecting on our own experiences with the South African regime. And it was really turbulent times in the 90s, you know, at the height of the struggle, you know, and mass democratic movement, UDF, you know, there were just concerts, cultural concerts everywhere. So you are constantly being fed with information, constantly experiencing this regime that we all knew we didn't want, you know. And at university, you're also very free, so you could do anything. And we just kept on performing My Home, My Prison. I think we had about 65 performances at the time. When we performed at like a technicon or at a teacher's college, the following day they would go on strike, and that's how powerful this thing was. And you'd hear them singing our songs of the play. So it was really an amazing time.
And did you find any sort of what's the word? Or like opposition to your performances? I mean, did you get to some places and people knew, obviously, your reputation was building, and then you were prevented in any way?
No, I think we were welcome. What was scary, I think there was one year we were going to the Grahamstown Festival and we had just rehearsed until late. When we came back, the security at the door, we stayed in Hillbrow, he said to us, because we used to come like 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning, he said, hey guys, you guys must just be careful, it's not okay. Okay, he didn't really elaborate, and then I think we got in, we took a bottle, a liter of cool drink to go and buy a cool drink. Then we got into the shop, but there was no one in the streets, and then these guys, they just chased us around the city. So we still don't know what happened and why that happened, and we couldn't go into the building. We had to call our friend, now the CEO of the Baxter Theatre, Lara Food, to come and fetch us, because we couldn't go in there. It was scary, and these guys were just chasing us. They were not chasing anybody else, but it was us. We still don't know today what happened, and then we didn't want to go to Grahamstown. So that is the only one incident that was really directly linked with us, that we saw, hey, Pravek, hey, this Chandismus, because the situation is really bad. But the security had warned us, said there's been this car that had been roaming around. But other than that, wherever we went, I mean, we performed at TUT, it used to be TNT at the time, in Soshanguve, and I think we had about 1,000 people in that big hall, and after the performance they carried us around, you know, they made us feel like superstars. It was just amazing. They gave us cases of beer, money after the performance. Just that's one performance I'll never forget.
That's interesting, because you would think, even though what you depicted on stage was against what the government wanted people to hear or know of back in the day, that you still didn't face a lot of opposition. Did you ever get the opportunity to perform in front of different races and different racial audiences?
Yes,
and we did. How was the reception there?
It was good. I mean, My Home, My Prison was quite strong. It was a strong experimental piece. It was very violent as well. And coming from vets, basically you had a mixed audience there, you know, as opposed to when you go to TUT, TNT at the time, it's just black audiences. In Grahamstown, you're performing for a mixed audience. I mean, you know, this was on the trails of Sinamali, Bopa, like that deep protest theater that was experimental, that was highly physical. And we were just following on that, and people could relate to those styles. But importantly at the time, people could relate to the stories, because we all knew what, unless if you were really ignorant, we knew what was happening in the country, and we knew how the police treated us. And that is what we were expressing in the production of My Home, My Prison. But we were also talking to the spies, the people, the sellouts, you know, the people that would really sell you out. And that production was talking about that. But we were also saying, we feel that we are in our home, but we are so much in prison.
Wow.
But at that stage, you know, it isn't just your sort of creative desires that are now fueling you forward. Like, if you look at people now, you know, they become playwrights, they go to acting schools, whatever, because they want to be a star or they want to be in a role. Did you feel back then there was a lot more about what you were doing there? It was also about getting this word across the country as well.
It was about that, but for me, you know, there were very few black directors. And like I said, that I quit acting because I was doing well as an actor. I mean, I'd worked with Paul Slabolepsi back then, you know, Megan Wilson, Lionel Newton, you know, some of the great white actors and playwrights, and with Lara, one of the most amazing directors. And so I had a chance, and I was very young, but I knew then that if I did not create work for myself, it means that I'm going to have to be running down the streets every day, catching a cab to Johannesburg to go for auditions and to tell the stories that I don't necessarily want to tell. Because then I auditioned for a Pento. That's why I stopped. You know, Janice Honeyman's Pento, I went there for an audition. And when I came back, I just said, this is not going to work. You know, this, I'm not going to be doing a Pento, and dancing, what is my role as an artist. And when I drove back, when I got home, I just said, no more auditions for me, no more acting for me. I want to focus on writing, because I knew that through creating work, we can actually reflect our times. We can actually question what is happening in our country. But importantly, 10 years down the line, when people look at our work, they must be saying, wow, in 2012, this is the story that they spoke about. In 2012, people were massacred in Marikana. You know, in 2016, students stood up and said, we want free education, because that's our role as playwrights. You don't want, like, 20 years down the line and young people are trying to find out what happened in 2016, what were the challenging issues, and I've been doing a pantomime. You know, so it was there that let us reflect our rhythm, let us tell our stories. Also because I felt that we needed to tell our own stories, our own experiences for generations to come.
Now, you don't seem like you're a person that's afraid of any sort of topic. There's no sort of big issue here that you might shy away from. Would that be a fair statement?
I think it would be fair. You know, on Friday we just did some amazing production. It was one night only called Freedom with a cast of 60. Set the band on top of the roof on the fourth floor, and it was just an experience. It was an experience for the people that got an opportunity to see that, which was dealing with really current issues. When I was creating Marikana, the commission of inquiry was on, so that was very scary for me. It was like, oh God, what am I doing? Should I really be doing this? But I think that it is the role of an artist to do that. If we do not do that, art should really examine the status quo. Art should question the status quo. We shouldn't just accept things as they are and leave it like that. And it's quite difficult in South Africa, because art is supported by government. So you could find yourself doing agitprop all the time, but art is supported by government, and which is really good that a government is funding the artists. So you get to that point where you do not know, do you bite the hand that feeds you?
Sure.
You know? So that's what really makes it a little bit difficult. Like, you'll see post-apartheid, there has not really been a lot of work that was examining all these issues. There's not been a lot of work that say, if at all we're talking corruption in a country, that's really dealing with that and is pointing a finger. Because you'd have gone to the National Arts Council or the Department of Arts and Culture to give you money, so the next thing you're coming there and you want to point a finger at them. So that has been the difficult thing in the country, I think, for a lot of artists, because they depend on government to put up production. But at the same time, I felt that there has never really been censorship from the government. I've always said that I felt that we artists have censored themselves because they're afraid. But there's never really been, even when we did Marikana, a whole lot of people would have expected that, you know, I got letters. Of course, in the beginning, it was really scary. But then there's never been, like, the Department of Arts and Culture saying, you cannot do that work. So it is our role. We must take that responsibility and take a risk and take a chance and say, this is the times that we live in and they are like this, and really challenge that and ask questions.
So aside from, you know, getting the funding from the Department of Arts and Culture, for example, with a storyline such as Marikana, you know, you did the musical, you got 18 Naledi Award nominations, you won 6. Aside from the Department of Arts and Culture, do you then also talk to the people whose story you are telling to get permission to tell the story, or do you start writing, gather your information from news reports, and then put the storyline together?
It's you know, with Marikana, imagine how many people we would have to consult with to do that production.
Well, yeah, we saw that commission, yeah. How long that was.
You know, so for me, I think that sometimes you need permission, but I don't need permission to examine society. It's my role as a playwright. It could be courteous to do that, but I was in a very fortunate position with Marikana because I adapted a book. So the book was already written by those journalists, you know, Lucas, Leon, Atandwa, Felix Langamandla, and Sibaba Tsomsamo. So they had come there with a book. They've been there on the ground forever, ever since the tragedy started, the massacre started. So they've been there. So for me, I was fortunate that there was, the book was called We Are Going to Kill Each Other Today, the story of Marikana, you know.
Wow.
Because that was even one way that was said by some of the miners there, that we're going to kill each other today. So they wrote that book. So I had all that material from people that had first hand experience, people that were on the, I mean, even when you see the newspaper clips, you still see those guys that wrote that book there, you know. You see them running. We always joke with Leon because he thought he was shot. Apparently he was just checking himself after there'd been gunshots on the 12th of August. He thought that they had shot him, and even when we did the play, those guys were messed up in the head for a very long time. They were like, that's all we spoke about, and they were really messed up. So it was also healing for them because they've been there, they've seen those shots being fired. So I didn't get permission from the people from the victims or their spouses or siblings, but I got the rights to do the book from the authors.
But how does something like that work? Because obviously in any creative industry, you become massively invested in something, right? Now, Americana is forever going to be something in our history that we're going to look at, and it's going to be a very sad thing for all involved, primary, secondary, no matter what. How did you deal with seeing that Americana in the news? I mean, is it something that still kind of affects you a lot?
It does, yeah, it does. You know, when I the first time I saw Americana,
because we haven't really got the closure that I think any of us are looking for. Yeah.
No, we haven't. I first saw it. I think I arrived here on the 13th in South Africa on the 13th of August. I was from Scotland from a festival. Silent Voice was playing there, which is one of my plays. And I got home and I switched on the TV, and that's the first thing I saw. So I couldn't really figure out what was happening. So I started calling and saying, "What is happening?" And then they tell me, "No, man, this has happened yesterday." And I, my whole trip, you know, every time you come from abroad, you want to make pap and have meat and all that. And I couldn't even eat pap that morning and gravy and all that. I just sat there and I just didn't know what to do. I just thought, what is happening in my country? So it was really bad. And then when Lucas called me and sent me an SMS and said, I want you to, we've written this book. I want you to adapt it into a musical about Americana. Okay, musical Americana. I said, okay, let's get the book. We sent somebody to get the book. I read that book and finished it. I never stopped. I read that book and finished it the following morning. I said, I want to do this thing. And now, even every time you see it, you're like, no, you know, it's like fresh all the time. Even now, we started rehearsing. We are starting to rehearse today. Even yesterday, the whole cast from Durban, everybody came and we decided to meet because it's quite a very united cast. There's a lot of people, but because of the subject, really, because that's how it affects them. So the moment you come there, what we just do, they just start singing the songs and just and then you just have tears in your eyes. So it's
sure. Wow. Now, going from that, Nelson Mandela's memorial service. Now, this is something like to get be involved in. Obviously, it's a great honor to who you are as a person. But how difficult was that again? You know, talking about the emotional side of things. There's no way so you're not going to be emotionally invested in this. Like, how does that process work?
That was hard. Wow, that was hard because we it was in the middle of our festival in December, and we had the news that he's gone. And we knew we had to do a memorial. I spoke to Mamswengile Khumalo and said, let's do this. But I thought, I didn't want to do a concert. I just didn't want to have people coming there and singing and singing and singing. Yeah. I said, I'm going to tell the story. I think I spent that whole night writing it.
It deserves something new.
Yeah, so I wrote the whole story from his childbirth to Rivonia trial. It was fortunate that I had done Rivonia trial.
Sure.
And we had staged a Rivonia trial. Firstly, it was a four-hour production, Rivonia trial. It was supposed to be 8 hours. Then we chopped it to four hours.
Wow.
We chopped it to 2 hours. So I had all that material. So I put that together. I knew the actors were not going to be ready with that. So I put all their scripts on clipboards, all of them, Selomake and them, they came. And so we used the music of the artist, everybody, Simpiwe, who was there, Selokhalani, Okwe, you know, all those guys. We used their music to advance the story. So we basically did a big musical because a whole lot of artists volunteered. I think we had about 180 to 200 artists who came, dancers. So it just became a spectacle and just became a great send off. And it was in the opera theater in the state theater has never been that full. I don't think it ever will be because it was just packed everywhere. And Jerry Mufokeng, I remember in the script, Jerry Mufokeng was singing Nelson Mandela, and I told him exactly what was going to happen when that song starts. If he sings it, sobs, and he started singing Nelson Mandela, and then just that whole house just started singing, but quietly. It never became that big one when we were celebrating, and you had like 1,400 people just going Nelson Mandela, and you just cry, man.
Now, are you still traveling quite a lot internationally with your work?
This year, I haven't traveled a lot. In the past 2 years, I haven't done a lot of new work, except I started doing work this year. But this year, no, I haven't traveled yet.
Now, the reason I ask is, so, you know, obviously what you spoke about now are the various things that South Africans are known about overseas. So were you to go over to a place, say Scotland, like you mentioned there, and you were to mention South Africa, obviously Madiba's legacy is something that people relate to. Moving to current day, you know, like we're worried that maybe, you know, what is the rest of the world thinking of South Africa now, because the news that comes out is very negative. Do you feel like a lot of the positive legacies are now being tarnished and almost forgotten about in light of these new scandals?
I can't really say maybe until I engage material or something really a switch goes in my head and I think I really need to do that. What I know is that, you know, maybe if you're born post 94, you can feel that not much has been achieved or things are not moving.
Yeah.
But if you've been there before, you know how much has been achieved in this country, how much more has been done. So you really appreciate that, because it will be a lie for me or anybody of my age to say nothing has been done. Because so much, if you grew up in Soshanguve and you go to Soshanguve now, you can see the change. If you go to the Thabong High, the school where I went, you can see a change. So much has been achieved. But I think that we know in South Africa that we can actually do better. We know that we can be on top of the world because of what we have, the skills that we have, the resources that we have. We know that it can be better. We know that we can be governed better. And that is why we are such a vocal society. And I think it's important. I think it's great. I think that's actually what's keeping South Africa alive, is that the people in South Africa, they are not going to keep quiet. They are going to speak and they're going to fight. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big plus for us, because we are not a quiet nation. We're not just going to let things happen.
Yeah, that's a good
point. You know? So I think that you have to have both. You know, we have to have that theater and those stories that really question the status quo and challenges the status quo, because it's our role. But you also have to have agitprop, and not even agitprop, if I could say that. But you also have to have that theater and those stories that say, hey, we are a great country, we are a great nation, and we are a happy people with all our troubles. So it's got to be balanced.
But exactly, because we lose sight of these things, right? Because nowadays it's all about the news, right? The media feed all kinds of things, right or wrong.
Yes.
We are being plugged into these different sort of narratives at times, whereas someone like you as a storyteller, you must see things very, very differently. Not because you live in a world of fantasy, it's because you're actually there amongst the storytelling process. So with that in mind, do you have like a next big story that you would love to tell?
I showcased Freedom on Friday. I did one performance only. I think the one way people could explain it on Friday, they were saying it's epic. It was huge. It was big. It dealt with today. I mean, the story centered up around this female, a character called Pindile, who's leading the Fismas Fall student march.
Okay.
And she's very strong. She's very strong. But she's got this boyfriend who is really abusing her like you cannot believe. And the scene was just shocking, the way we did it on Friday. And he beats her up. So it's her having to break out of that. And you know, from somebody who used to wear hoodies and all that. And once this guy beat her up, she decides, no, I'm going to show off my scars. I'm still going to go out there and fight. And she goes to fight there and she still gets arrested. You know, it was like, this voice, this female voice that represents our sisters and mothers, that comes out there and say, we still got to fight. So I think that is really powerful. It's an amazing story. The music, it's almost hip-hop. And Panzula, written by Kabelo Bonafide, Tohoe Mdun Thabo, did the choreography. I think it's the next big thing.
Do you find this country still surprises you?
This country will always surprise you.
Because I mean, from all that you've seen, Aubrey, the amount of stories that you've been involved in, that it still has the ability to surprise someone like you.
Yeah, it always, you always like, you know, whether good or bad, you know, you go to Grahamstown, you don't have accommodation. The people in the Eastern Cape, they put you in their house. They go and live next door and put you in their house, sometimes for nothing, and still make water for you in the morning. And you think, wow, do you still get people like this in the world? And you say, yeah, this is bad. And then you're walking in the streets of Pretoria, and then, or you're on the roads, and you have this white guy who's just agitated because he thinks you've cut him, and he's just going crazy. You know, if you stop there, he's going to pull out a gun and shoot you.
It's probably Garrett.
so you got all these things that are happening in the country, you know. So, and then you turn around the corner and you see a young kid there who doesn't work, who's begging. So you see all these things in South Africa. I think it never ceases to amaze.
But ultimately, you see optimism. You see hope amongst all of this.
I think yes. I think because of the way South Africans are, I think there's hope. I don't think that South Africa will crumble to the ground. I think it will rise.
But more so, what I'm gathering is your role as a playwright is you literally just show a mirror to society. This is what we're going through. This is what is happening. And you almost leave it open-ended for a person to be able to come up with their own conclusion or their own point of view. But do you ever have your own personal hope of what sort of conversation takes place with your work? So case in point, with a topic like Marigana, where some people may be still be touchy, where people on Twitter may take the topic to shreds, is there a specific intention where you go, with this work, I hope there's X?
I even with Marikana, you know, at the time when we were doing it, the commission was still on. So that was the, firstly, for me as a playwright, it was risky, you know. It could have just brought me down. It could have just finished my career because I could have got it all wrong.
Yeah, that's what we were discussing earlier, actually. It's a big risk.
Yes, it was a big, big risk, but, you know, but it was worth taking. But what during our afternoon performances, we want to engage, you know, we want to have a conversation with people. There was one conversation, I think we had the EFF guys there, just went off the wall, you know, it was like crazy. But that's the sort of conversation we must have, because we must be able to get into that room and fight and argue without a bullet being shot. And I think that's where we need to get to. I think we've gotten to a point, even if you look at Marikana, there was supposed to be a protest and fights, but there was not supposed to be pangas running. We're not supposed to have a bullet being shot. We should have just had a discourse and differed in our views. But I think even with Marikana, when we sit in there, there are people that don't agree with what I've written. There are people that say that we're saying maybe the police, you have not really shown the police as brutal as they have been. There are people, so you still have those views, but you can only deal with these things if we discuss them, if we talk about them. You know, we can only heal, because for me it was like, we need to heal, and to heal is to see it, experience it, talk about it, fight over it, as long as there's not one bullet fired or you know, a person is not stabbed, because we have to be that sort of a society where we can have an argument and differ, but knowing that we're not supposed to kill each other.
How much creative license do you exercise in each of your stories? Because, you know, your work is based heavily on societal problems, so it's, you know, a lot of it can be taken from facts that actually happened. But then I imagine that you also have to add a dramatic element to it to help, you know, bring the story to life. So how much creative license do you as a playwright take between telling the facts and then also dramatizing it?
Well, I try and stick to the facts, but obviously, you know, I could only have one commissioner in the play, right? So I couldn't have Mambombo or Mamriya and all that. So you have to take those people and make one person, say for an example, you know. So you take that license to get the nice flow of the story. And I was lucky with Marikana because the story, the way it happened in itself, it had a dramatic plot. You know, it just started on this time, and then this happened, and then they killed a policeman, they killed a couple of minors, and then the police came. So it's really taking the for drama, it's just making sure that it doesn't take 3 weeks to show that you can really do certain things at a particular time. But it's really combining those characters that can represent the other. So I think that is the license that I took when I was doing Marikana. But besides that, I just stuck to the facts, because I thought the facts were quite strong.
Well, Aubrey, that's some powerful work to consider here. Your latest work, Freedom. Where can people see that?
It was just one night only.
It was
the experience.
You big tease.
yes. We'll see if it comes back again. Last year, it was just to try and out to the people and say, what do you think of this work? You know, and really people enjoyed that.
Okay. And the dates for Marikana the musical?
We preview from the 11th of July, and we play until the 12th of August.
Fantastic.
Yes.
And that's all happening at the State Theatre in Pretoria.
All happening in the State Theatre and the Drama Theatre. Yes.
All right. So you can see Aubrey's work, State Theatre, on those dates. Aubrey, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
And obviously you just never ever stop telling the stories. I think, again, it's a great inspiration to the rest of us. That's
all I'm now thinking about is, well, then there's no retiree in plan for you at all, because it just takes one story to move you.
Aubrey's never going to retire. Looks younger and fitter than all of us put together.
That's the truth.
Thanks very much, Aubrey. Gareth, we'll be back tomorrow, hopefully. Today he obviously was a little bit ill, so we hope he gets better. And we'll be back tomorrow as well. Usual story, Tuesday, the 4th of July. So we'll have some American-style themes. Sia will probably wear more American underwear. So really, there is just so much to look forward to.
As long as he doesn't show it to us, Ben. Yeah. I mean, I don't know why I had to see what's happening.
There's nothing wrong
pants.
With the little flash. That's all it is.
Yeah, on a camera, not in your middle area. All right, catch you back tomorrow. Thanks for joining us today.
This is CliffCentral.com.